Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Yesterday, I saw on X, or formerly Twitter, something that disturbed me, and apparently a lot of other X users, a gay couple in Pennsylvania, two men who crowdfunded their surrogacy journey. In other words, they managed to con enough people to pay for them to rent out a functioning womb, which neither of these males has. They now have custody of a baby boy, despite one partner, Brandon Keith Riley Mitchell, that last name is hyphenated, predictably, maybe because they couldn't agree on which one of them would take the other's last name, despite Mr. Riley Mitchell being a convicted child sex offender. It seems the couple used a surrogacy loophole that bypasses state adoption restrictions on registered sex offenders. So now these two are showing off a cutesy video on social media in which they can't stop nuzzling their new accessory, I mean baby boy, whom I pray God will protect from this predator and his partner. Now, I have pretty strong feelings about convicted child sex offenders of any sexual orientation. One day, when I'm emperor of the world, not only will convicted child sex offenders not be able to adopt children, they also won't be taking up oxygen that the rest of us could be enjoying. This state of affairs, in which what are essentially made-to-order children are purchased and brought into a relationship, regardless of how loving and stable it may seem, that does not provide the child with both a mother and father, is becoming, unfortunately, normalized. I'm looking at you, Pete Buttigieg. And the reason I say unfortunately is because these are situations in which adults have prioritized their self-centered whims over the best interests of the child. This fashionable trend in our cultural decline needs to come to a screeching halt. And to elaborate on why this is such a critical issue and a tragedy for children and our society, I have a guest today of whom I'm a big admirer, a woman whose work is focused on protecting the rights of children and ensuring that our society is first and foremost devoted to raising the next generation to be emotionally healthy and stable instead of confused and even traumatized. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already, so you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we're having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, which I'll ask her about in a moment. That's also the title of her important book, Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement. As you listeners know, I read every book that I ask my guests about, and I highly recommend this one. She is also the author of a second book, or co-author, Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City, and she's the editor of a third book, and both of those books we'll get to. Katie Faust, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
It's such a joy to be with you, Mark. Thanks for having me.
The feeling is mutual. Thank you for coming on. So much I want to talk to you about because your work covers so much ground. And it's so vital, not just to parents, but to society at large. First, tell us about Them Before Us. What goes on there? What's its mission and why did you launch it?
Well, what are we trying to do? Very briefly, we are gunning for a global takeover. That's probably the best way to summarize everything that we have going on here. I want to take over the world on behalf of children. I want every conversation about marriage, family, parenthood, divorce, reproductive technologies, IVF, surrogacy, adoption, cohabitation, polygamy, to first ask, what about the child? What are the child's needs? What are their rights? What do they deserve? To whom do they have a natural right? And then I want all adults, single, married, gay, straight, fertile, and infertile, to conform to those fundamental child rights. And then in the political conversation, I want children to be the primary concern whenever we're talking about policy decisions or court cases. I think that the most vulnerable among us, who have the most to lose when we get these questions wrong, should be the dominant voice in all of these different discussions.
Your activism, that does not come naturally or comfortably to you, does it? When you first began writing about this topic, you wanted to stay anonymous.
Oh, yeah. I didn't want to start writing about this. And then I did it only anonymously because I like to keep my friends and I love to be loved and I hate to be hated. And conflict and confrontation is something I'll do when needed as a last resort. But generally, I'm a peacemaker and a peacekeeper. So it's definitely outside of my comfort zone. But I was on with Jordan Peterson a couple months ago and talked about his like big five personality test. And there's like one of those aspects is agreeability. I am highly agreeable, like 85%. I will let so many things go. I overlook all kinds of like quirks or struggles or insults, that kind of thing. But once you tip into that 15%, I just go nuclear. And that's what I saw happening in the marriage and family space was this complete victimization of children, this severing of their primary bonds, this sacrificing of their God-given needs to validate adults, to satisfy adults, to deliver sometimes custom ordered children to adults who are sometimes revealed to be predators as we're watching, you know, swirl around on X right now. That kind of thing, it makes my blood boil. And that's why I decided to get into this because I could not stand by and let children be victimized in their primary relationships. And so it started as an anonymous blog. I got outed by a powerful gay blogger who doxed members of my church to get me to shut up. And it just ended up kind of growing from there.
Well, that really speaks to your passion and your conviction about the topic that you were willing to get out of that comfort zone and do what you do. Katie, in America and in the Western world, generally speaking, we've entered a post-Christian phase in which the dominant religion, a secular religion, is what's been called expressive individualism. That religion prioritizes personal identity and personal expression and desires above all else. And anything that hinders that imperative is considered oppressive and evil. In your book, Them Before Us, you argue that children's rights to their biological mother and father should take precedence over those kinds of adult desires. Can you summarize the core evidence or the reasoning behind that and why you think it's so critical for our culture?
Well, first of all, I think that there has been a resurgence and a newfound understanding of the importance of parental rights to their own children. Like we have seen that awaken, you know, in the wake of Governor Youngkin's election, that new voting bloc of parents has emerged. And then especially as the transgender movement has crept into schools and doctor's offices and worked to sever and weaken the bonds between parent and child, a lot of parents have risen up and said, "Get your hands off my kid." And I want to shine a light on the fact that that relationship works in reverse too. It's not just that parents have a right to their own children. Children have a right to their own mother and father. And if we fail to defend that fundamental right, then what we're saying is children are accessories to be acquired or delivered or assigned to any adults with the money and means to contractually arrange their conception and gestation and birth. And really what we're talking about is if we reject that children have a fundamental right to their own mother and father, we are saying they're no longer subjects of rights. They're now objects of rights, items that can be attained. Now, maybe that's not a threat to you and your relationship to your own children, but as people who are centered around and concerned about justice for the least of these, that actually is the business of all of us. And it actually does infringe on our own relationship with our children too, which we can discuss later. But why is it that children's claim and right to their own mother and father is so critical? What is it that these two adults do for children that no other adult can do for them? And I boil it down when I'm speaking or writing to these three areas. Number one, a child's own mother and father grant them something that they crave, and that is access to their biological identity. It is very hard for children to answer the question, "Who am I?" if they cannot answer the question, "Whose am I?" And this is one of the reasons why in adoption in this country for domestic adoption, we have seen a drastic shift away from closed adoptions, which were the norm in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, to now 95% of adoptions in the United States are open adoptions. Because social workers have recognized that even if a child can't be raised by their first family, they benefit from as many connections, contact, knowledge of their first family as possible, even if they can't be raised by them. And so, and I say this as an adoptive mother, like, I can't fully compensate for everything my child has lost. And that openness, that knowledge of their biological roots is very important for identity consolidation and formation. So number two, a child's own mother and father are statistically the most connected to, invested in, and protective of kids. And if you want to create a system where children are most likely to be safe and loved, it is with their own biological parents married to one another in a permanent relationship. I mean, there's been an awful lot of cultural promotion that children don't need a mom and dad, and biology is irrelevant. They just need caregivers or safety or love. And I'm like, okay, I also agree that children need to be safe and loved. We don't have to guess about the factors that lead to a child being safe and loved. We know from decades of social science research, or just Googling the words mother's boyfriend, that not everybody offers the same benefit to children as their own married biological mother and father. So when we take a step away from that understanding of the nuclear family, what we're doing is we're saying we're okay with child victimization, because those two things always go hand in hand. And then finally, if a child is being raised by both biological parents, then they automatically get the perfect gender balance in the home, right? The male parent and the female parent that offer distinct and complementary benefits as it relates to the distinctions in how they talk to kids and how they discipline kids and how they roughhouse or play, what they focus on, mothers attaching and fathers encouraging separation, mothers honing children's fine motor skills, dads honing children's gross motor skills, women encouraging equity and safety, fathers encouraging appropriate risk-taking and adventure. If you are missing a male parent or a female parent, the child is going to be malformed, malnourished, and I would say hungry, not just for the developmental aspect they're missing, but hungry for the male or female love that all kids crave. So when we are defending children's fundamental rights to their mother and father, we are talking about every factor that leads to child flourishing, child protection, and identity formation.
I'm totally with you on all of that. You write about and talk about the importance of natural law in shaping family policy. I imagine you meet with a ton of resistance from audiences or critics who literally do not believe in natural law, who believe that families are just social constructions and that we can deconstruct and reconstruct families at will and socially engineer a sort of utopian society out of all that. Is that true?
Yeah. Like, if you want to say that children have a natural right to their mother and father, and, you know, I do it not using scripture, even though I'm an absolute Bible thumping nutter. I make my case based on the social science, the natural law, the common sense, the stories of children. But there is massive resistance to this, because if it is true that biology matters in the parent-child relationship, that they are not little widgets that can be acquired and assigned, that's a wrecking ball for modern family. And it's a wrecking ball for sexual autonomy. And that is, as far as I can tell, the most highly exalted god of, you know, I would say American culture, but maybe Western civilization overall. Currently, that is the thing that we protect at all costs. We create classes of adults based on their sexual preference, sexual feelings, sexual choices. And to oppose that is to oppose the god of our age. So arguing based on children's natural rights, based in natural law, supported by biological reality and high level of social science scholarship, is to trigger, I would say, the cultural elites among us. And yet it is, you know, that old saying that says you can drive nature out with a pitchfork, but it's always going to come roaring back. These are truths that are not going to be ignored, or they will be ignored at our peril.
Now, you yourself grew up with divorced parents and a mother in a lesbian relationship. How did your personal experience shape your perspective on all this?
Well, I didn't start writing out of some kind of personal axe to grind. I actually had a really close relationship with both my mother and father before and after the divorce. And I wasn't raised as a Christian at all. And then even when I did become a Christian, the main aspect of Christianity that I pulled from was I need to be loving and devoted to my mother and father. Not that I need to be highly critical of their choices, even though obviously both of them made decisions that were a departure from what was best for me and what was best in terms of God's design for the family. So what did it do for me? It actually, especially in relation to my mother and her partner, who are still together after 40 years and who I see regularly and who have a very good relationship with, is what it really did is it gave me a deep, deep heart for people that identify as LGBTQ. I mean, like, when I start arguing with the blue-haired activist online, I'm like, honey, you know, she's like, oh, you're anti-gay, homophobic. And I just am like, baby, I've been living with lesbians since way before you were born. So, you know, it's a bit of a inoculation. Like, you don't get to say that I hate gay people because I don't. And I just think that is probably one of the most vicious, manipulative, emotionally manipulative tactics that I think has ever been leveraged against like conservatives and Christians, because nobody hates their gay family and friends, but it's a very, very powerful tool to silence us. So that's really what I got from my upbringing, is I can love and should love and be in relationship with people who disagree and not give one damn inch on marriage and family because it's matters of child protection.
Your book critiques practices that prioritize adult desires like divorce and donor conception and same-sex parenting, and you've been addressing all that so far. But your book really nicely balances data-driven arguments with emotional examples of children who have been affected by family breakdowns or non-traditional structures. Can you give us a story or two, apart from your own, of testimony that you've encountered that highlights the impact of practices like these on, you know, children?
Yeah. And it's very, very important that those of us who care about marriage and family start to wield the most powerful weapon in the culture war. And that is the stories of children who have been victimized. The reason why the other side has, in essence, frayed and then re-knit together in a distorted fashion the fabric of society is not because they had data, not because they had common sense, not because they had natural law, not because any of the five major religions of the world agreed with them. It is because they elevated personal narrative and lived experience above the data, above common sense. And unfortunately, I would like for data or natural law or biblical truth to be the governing force, but it's not. So what the other side has done so effectively is, number one, they misidentified the victims. They said adults who do not get what they want are victims. We need to properly identify the victims. The victims, the real victims of surrogacy gone wrong or surrogacy in general or the redefinition of marriage or divorce is not the adults who are sad or who have a longing or loss or need validation. It is children. Children who will lose partially or fully a relationship with their mother or father. So number one, properly identify the victims and then humanize them. And you do that through using their stories. So for example, the one woman who is currently the only person born through surrogacy who is speaking out about this is a woman named Olivia Morel, because she's French. And she talks about how even though she was raised by a very wealthy mother and father, her father was biologically related, her mother was not, she had endless nannies, went to the best schools, split time between Paris and her, you know, mansion in Florida. She constantly suffered from abandonment issues. She always felt like someone was about to leave her. And she will trace that back to the primal wound of losing her birth mother on the day that she was born. And that no amount of money or even another woman, a mother, or even dozens of nannies in her life could substitute for that primal relationship, could make up for that primal loss that she experienced the day she was born. And she's not wrong. Like, so we start with telling stories like Olivia's, where she says, every single time my parents left for a vacation or walked out of the room, I would fall apart into a screaming mess, petrified that they were never coming home, even though they always did. And we would say, she is not insane. Children who lose their mother at birth, surrogate children or adoptees, often have higher rates of externalizing disorders, attachment struggles, anxiety, depression, because you can't tinker with that fundamental relationship that children form with their mothers and not expect some kind of fallout, right? So lead with story and then follow up with the data. Another woman that I know who has spoken out and written about this, who was raised by two lesbians, will talk about how she was a really good kid. Like she, if you had asked her as a child, do you like having a lesbian mom? Do you like having, she would say, of course I do. Because children are naturally protective of their parents. And by design, right? You want them to have an allegiance to, a dependence on their own mother and father. And in this case, you know, she was allied with her mother and then went along with whatever partner was in the home. And yet every single time she heard a plane fly over her house when she was 6 or 9 or 12, she would run outside to the backyard and wave hoping that her father was on the plane looking down at her. And it's like, it's those kinds of stories where you go, yep, this is what children want. This is who they are. You know, there's another woman who was raised by two men who was well-loved. She would say in her own words, I was well-loved by my gay father and his boyfriend. And I felt cherished. But then I watched The Land Before Time when I was a kindergartner. And I realized there was something called mother. And it was a parent who was a woman. And I didn't know that there was mother. I didn't know mother existed. And then I watched that movie and I suddenly realized that I didn't have a mother and I desperately wanted one. And I spent the next several years trying to get any woman in my life, my dad's lesbian friends, female teachers, to mother me and asking them, will you be my mother? Will you be my mother? Because there was something in there, something that I needed that my two gay dads could not provide. So it's those kinds of stories. And we've got about 120 of them in our first book, Them Before Us, because you need to know these stories. It is good to have data. It is good to employ natural law. It is good to have high levels of scholarship. And we do have all of that. We've got hundreds and hundreds of footnotes in the book, but it is the stories that will drive home the urgency and the necessity of speaking up about this, even if it means you might lose some friends.
Katie, our society's never been perfect in the ways that we treat or raise children. So I'm not just waxing nostalgic here for a time that never existed, but how did we devolve into a society that either neglects children terribly or exploits and weaponizes them politically in service to an agenda?
I think it's what you said at the very beginning, is this exaltation of adult sexual expressionism, right? And what was Carl Truman's word that you used at the very beginning?
Oh, expressive individualism.
Expressive individualism.
Carl Truman, right.
Yeah, Truman. And you know that we have reoriented our mind away from a social fabric that recognized that families were critical. And we've shifted that over to individuality, especially as it relates to sexual decision making. And so we've just shifted our focus. You know, if you want to use Jordan Peterson speak, our hierarchy of values, there's no longer, you know, something that resembles community or even family that's at the hierarchy of values. Now it is simply adult freedom and adult expression that's at the top. And anytime adult sexual expression is God, children are the necessary sacrifice. Those two things are always going to go hand in hand. So either you can put children first and adults will sacrifice for them. And all adults, I'm not just talking about the gay adults, I'm talking about the adults who are struggling with fertility and the adults who are in the middle of their challenging season of marriage and the ones who are single and wished that they were married. I mean, every adult at some point is going to have to make the decision, is it them, the kid, or is it me, the adult? And right now, everything in our society says, oh, it's you. And the kids will be fine. In fact, they'll love it if you elevate your own desires above their needs. Because after all, your happiness is exactly what they want their parent to be happy. They want their mother to be free of their father who doesn't do 50% of the housework. And they really want you to be emotionally fulfilled by running off with that guy who actually understands you, not their father who's working 50 hours a week so that you can be a stay-at-home mother. I mean, like, these are the messages that we're getting, is that not only is it good for you, but it's good for your kids. And those are all the messages that we're getting. So we need to get back to the place where we say, no, children actually have fundamental, concrete, non-negotiable, unbending, inalienable rights to their mother and father. And if that's true, that means you, the adult, are going to have to sacrifice at some point.
You've written about the sexual revolution and its harm to children. And again, I'm right with you on this. The sexual revolution, far from being liberating, it's really wreaked terrible havoc on society. Is it possible for us to undo this damage to any extent as a culture, or once a culture declines or becomes decadent in this way, do we just have to live with the consequences?
There was a researcher, J.D. Unwin, who I think studied like 86 different societies throughout the last several hundred years and charted the course of their cultural demise. And it was, he drew a direct line between forsaking complete virginity prior to marriage and chastity after marriage, just the monogamous heterosexual commitment within marriage, And he said, within 3 decades, if you forsook that, if you said, we are going to reject virginity prior to marriage, we're going to reject fidelity once you're in marriage, once we're going to be flexible on those sexual boundaries, like permissive of casual premarital sex, permissive of extramarital sex once you are married, incorporating other forms of sexual gratification, whether it's homosexuality or polygamy, once you start to bend on those sexual boundaries, within 3 generations, there's complete societal collapse. And even to the point of a rejection of being able to think rationally. I'm like, well, here we are, 3 generations after the sexual revolution, and we are seeing all of that. So can you claw it back? I don't know. Unwin didn't talk about societies that recovered from this, but there is no recovery unless you substitute something. You either return to your original vision of sexual fidelity and the importance of that, or you replace it with something that is better. I don't think that there is a replacement. I think we simply need to return. And that is absolutely not going to happen unless child rights are at the center of that. I would also say that if you're a religious practicing Christian, Catholic, Jew, Mormon, that your whole worldview is built around these sexual practices that I would say are God's plan A for child protection. And it's a mandate, honestly, that believers need to take seriously, advancing the message that children's fundamental rights are at stake when we compromise or soften these boundaries, these borders, these messages about marriage and family. And you, the church, are God's agents on the planet to ensure that children are protected. I mean, like in the Old Testament, we've got like 39 verses about protecting the fatherless. Compromising on sex and marriage is actually endorsing, manufacturing, and promoting the creation of fatherless children and motherless children now, thanks to surrogacy. So can we get out of this? Not without a child-centric message and not without religious believers choosing to be courageous on behalf of children.
You've already answered this question to some extent, but you emphasize that redefining marriage redefines parenting to the detriment of children. I'm totally with you on this, but polls show that over 2/3 of Americans now support same-sex marriage and more than 3/4 support abortion to one degree or another. Are you optimistic that we can turn the tide of those opinions and return to stronger values that put children first?
So I know there's a lot going on in the abortion space, and I'm not at the forefront of that fight, but let me talk about same-sex marriage and same-sex parenting. Yes, support for same-sex marriage is still high, but it has dropped 16 points in the last 3 years among Republicans. We are down from a high of 55%. Now we are, where are we at? Like 44 or something. And it has been drastic. A lot of that is because the T in the LGBT has overplayed its hand, but some of it is because we are now seeing more and more pictures of gay men acquiring children and then subsequently abusing them. When I first started posting about this, especially on X, maybe in 2018, 2019, 2020, I would post a picture of 2 men in a hospital bed with a baby, and I'd say, this is an injustice. Children should not lose their mother so that two men can acquire a child. And the dominant messages that I got was, looks like that kid's got 2 loving parents to me. No longer. Now I post a picture of 2 men with a surrogate born baby, and it goes viral. And, you know, with a lot of captions to the effect of, whatever makes this illegal, that's my politics. And so, especially because there's now more high profile cases of children being abused or being acquired by men who should have no business having children, it is opening people's eyes that normalizing these homes where a mother or father are absent actually victimizes children. So yes, I am optimistic. Optimistic for several reasons. Number one, this child-centric message no longer has the same level of gatekeepers that it did in 2015. We are now seeing the rise of independent media, a lot of different platforms, much stronger than MSNBC or CNN, who are, even if they're not completely on board with this message, are friendly to it and open to hearing the debates. Second, I think that when you reframe the conversation away from, should gay people be able to get married where there's a high degree of support, over towards, do children need a mother and father? you see much lower levels of support for normalizing same-sex headed households. So to me, my current challenge, my current battle that I'm working on and working to build a national coalition around this is to reframe the conversation about marriage away from adult fulfillment and towards child needs. And I think that when you couch it that way, we're going to see a much larger consensus and a huge coalition.
You collaborated with some contributors in a book called Pro-Child Politics. Now, when people think about political issues like energy or national security, policing, religious liberty, even race, they don't usually consider them through the lens of children. So how does your Children First approach unify topics like that? And how can people become more conscious of or intentional about applying that perspective to all political issues?
Well, the way that you can become more conscious of it is to read the book Pro-Child Politics. I was very fortunate to be the editor of that collection, but I didn't know enough about immigration to write about immigration from the perspective of prioritizing children. But Laura Reese at the Heritage Foundation did, and I don't think I'm an expert on the public school system and especially the teachers union, but Tiffany Justice, founder of Moms for Liberty, is. So she wrote my education chapter. And even though I could have written the life chapter on abortion and IVF, I got Abby Johnson to do it instead. I got Grover Norquist to write my taxes chapter. I mean, like, I got the people who know the most about these things. They've been doing the work for decades to say, what if you were to put kids first on issues of energy or issues of immigration or issues of national security? If you were to prioritize children, what would that policy look like? And unsurprisingly, it looks a lot like pure conservatism. There seems to be something about putting the rights of the next generation first that gets you to conservative policies, whether they're social conservatism, economic conservatism, or national conservatism. And I would say that that's probably the biggest rift between progressives and conservatives. Progressives are going to prioritize the immediate emotional fulfillment and desires and ideology of adults. And if you're doing conservatism right, you're going to benefit the next generation, even if the current generation needs to take a hit. So that's what, you know, Molly Hemingway said in her blurb at the beginning of Pro-Child Politics is that's what you get when you put kids first. You get genuine conservatism. So that was our attempt to say all of these things can and should be looked at through the lens of justice for children. And if you do that, you also get great environmental policy and you get great, you know, ideas about how to regulate pornography and you understand masculinity and femininity better.
In your other book, Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City, you and your co-author Stacey Manning share advice as mothers raising children in the very blue city of Seattle. Now, my wife and I homeschool our kids in Texas now, but we only recently moved from Southern California. So I understand that for countless conservative parents out there, navigating their kids through a progressive environment is a serious concern and it's a demanding process. What kind of help can you offer those parents?
This is a question for every parent, and I would say even grandparents who have children that are coming of age in this culture that is hell-bent on destroying them through some of the most wicked ideas that have ever been circulated among the youth. So Stacey and I have been doing this in Seattle largely with our kids going to public school without devoted extended family to lean on, but thank God with good church friends who have been able to be in the shoulder to shoulder with us. So basically, I could say with confidence that you can absolutely instill a biblical and a conservative worldview in your children, even if you're doing this alone, even if they're in public school, even if they're in a woke city. But I would say this is something that every parent needs to pay attention to, even if you're in a red state, even if you're homeschooling, even if they go to a great Christian or Catholic private school. The woke are coming for your kids. And you have to be aggressive, intentional, and proactive about forming their ideas about the world. And you need to do it from the minute they start talking. I'm not saying that you introduce them to the harms of gay sex when they're at the age of 7. But I am saying, and Stacey and I, you know, spill a lot of ink talking about what you do need to do for kids between especially the ages of 2 to 10 as it relates to laying a proper foundation, filling them with the good, true, and beautiful, so that when it does come to the time where they're in that logic phase of their middle school years, where you can then introduce the distortions to them, establish yourself as the expert on these topics, and inoculate them against a lot of the other forces, adults, voices, platforms that are seeking to undermine the good conservative Christian ideas that affirm the goodness of their own physical bodies, or the morality of the free market, or the truth about the American founding. I mean, all of those things are going to be under assault. We have found, Stacey and I, that you can not only instill this in your kids, but you make them like little leaders and founders of their own private tribes of friends. And like, they will lead a host of captives to sanity. And I'm not doing this because I want my children to be like missionaries in the public school. Like, that's just what ended up working for our family, for the different needs that we had in a variety of different ways. It's a testament that, like, with proper training in age appropriate ways, like equipping them for the fight in these specific cultural wars, your kids can be influencers of culture rather than influenced by culture.
You've already answered this next question to some extent, but I just wanted to address it a little bit. You usually speak to audiences of policymakers. I mean, you've spoken at the UN, you've testified before parliaments, but what are a couple of things that quote unquote ordinary people can do who are concerned about children's rights and stable families?
Okay. The number one thing is you need to become an expert. We are talking about things that not only have to do with national thriving, but national surviving. Like, do you want a country? Do you want a future? I mean, I want you to defend individual children and their individual rights and their individual needs because they are being victimized on an individual level. But if we don't get these conversations right on a macro level, we are ripe for colonization and capture by a variety of nefarious forces. So this is a matter of national survival, not just thriving for individual children, but surviving on a national level. You must become an expert on all things marriage and family. This is the engine through which we either rise or we fall. I mean, as you know, talking about Unwin's research in the past, but also like we are moving towards some incredibly dystopic technologies. Whether it is artificial wombs, robot nannies, the ability to create gametes out of skin cells or hair follicles from adults. I mean, we were talking about the possibility of mass producing children in factories that can be deleted out of existence based on an algorithm. I mean, like the kind of things in the technological space, in the cultural space, the cultural ideas that are permeating society. I mean, like, I swear every week there's a new article at the New York Times promoting ethical non-monogamy or whatever it is. And then, of course, the laws. I mean, you mentioned it before, but since gay marriage, our laws have completely inverted away from the importance of the preeminence of the parent-child relationship. Your relationship with your own biological children is being eroded without you even knowing it. We used to have this understanding that children belong to their own mother and father and vice versa, and it was untouchable by government. It was not something the government defined. It was something the government protected. But since gay marriage, the laws are being quietly in some places and aggressively in other places, completely eroded to the point where the government will very quickly decide whether or not you are the parent of your own biological child. I mean, the stakes are so high. Everybody needs to be an expert on this. That is one of the reasons why we wrote Them Before Us, our very first book. We hope that it is going to be a manual on how to think about all of these different issues. That's one reason why we have a church curriculum where we try to encourage Christians to think about cohabitation, surrogacy, IVF, modern families, divorce, the definition of marriage through the lens of child protection. That's one reason why we are working so hard to create a Substack to explain all of this in ways that help people digest it, articulate it, and then go out and replicate it. I mean, we just want to equip people, the normies, you who are listening. You don't have to be a podcaster. You don't have to be a politician. But we do need a groundswell of ordinary moms and dads who don't give one inch on any of this for the sake of protecting individual children, but also for the sake of, we'd like to have a country in a few years too.
Great answer. And I would say that everything you just said is true, not just on a national level, but on a civilizational level.
Yes.
Katie, I know that you are very active on X, where I follow you. Where should people go online to keep up with your commentary and what you're doing, and how can people support them before us?
Massive opinion dump on X. If you want my opinion about everything, even on like Advil and Tylenol, which I totally triggered a bunch of people about yesterday, it's all happening on X. That's probably the place where I'm the most active. Advo, A-D-V-O underscore K-A-T-Y on X. But if you go to thembeforeus.com, subscribe to our Substack. We are really working to keep everybody updated on the legislative threats to children, on the cultural threats to children. I don't think there's anybody else that is hitting the reproductive technologies as hard or as effectively as we are as it relates to educating people on the threats to children that IVF and surrogacy pose to kids. So come and let me equip you, let my team like fill you with truth to the point where you feel comfortable speaking up if this comes up, whether it's like at the coffee shop or the Thanksgiving table, or if it's something your legislators are voting on. Just come and let us equip you. And thembeforeus.com, if you want to fuel this movement, please donate. We have initiatives to target the human rights campaign that we are in process with. We are creating a national database on children's rights so you can look at your state and see where are children being victimized and how can you get on the fight. We are spearheading a coalition of every major national organization and state level organization. And if I have my way, every major cultural conservative platform to retake legal marriage on behalf of children. And if you want to get in on that, like come to thembeforeus.com and donate. And I swear I will use every penny to advance the rights of children.
Fantastic. Good to know. Katie Faust, thanks for joining us at The Right Take. And thanks especially for bringing all the energy and conviction and passion that you do to this important topic.
Thank you, Mark. It's a joy to be with you. I love David Horowitz, and it's a joy to be associated with him even marginally.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us. I urge you to check out Katie's work at Them Before Us and follow her on social media. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.